Good morning, everyone. And thanks for coming. My name is Steve Pond. I'm the department chair of the Department of Music. I'm actually not exactly that at the moment because I'm on sabbatical, but I did drag myself here this morning. I took a shower and everything, so I just want you to know it's okay. Our panel is going to be an interesting mix of people from art, architecture, and music. And I just want to kind of set a very brief context. I'm a jazz studies person, and I remember reading a Time magazine profile of the pianist Keith Jarrett, probably in the mid-1970s, right around the time he was doing his very acclaimed solo improvisations on piano, the Köln concert becoming the album record of that. And in that profile, I remember a story of him coming to the concert stage. There's a hush over the crowd. He sits at the piano. Everybody's at a respectful silence. And he sits. He's looking at the keyboard. And he keeps sitting. And he's looking at the keyboard. And he keeps sitting. Until somebody in the audience said, D flat minor. He said, thank you. Bang! Right? There's nothing worse than an absence of limitations. A blank canvas for an artist is a horrible thing. You need an idea. And not only do you need an idea, you need a limit on your ideas. You also need a conversation. Now, there are locations around the campus that are hotbeds of seething cauldrons of ideas forming and boiling together. Those are known as coffee shops and hallways and offices where people meet and talk together, living rooms. And there are also libraries where people engage with ideas in a written form of conversation, or in media presentations where people engage with what has come before them in various kinds of media. Gallery openings are great places for new ideas to come about. Conferences of an academic sort, but also of a less than hallowed type, are places where those conversations take place and where those limitations that are so necessary to our ideas also take form. Thinking about art as needing limitations and engagements with other scholars brings me to the thought about what we do as college professors. As professors, we basically have two jobs: learn stuff and share what we know. By learning stuff, it might be learning what has come before, putting a new interpretation on it, taking it forward to another position, another level of understanding, but also understanding our world as it exists, as we encounter it, and as we encounter it together. So it's always a matter of being engaged with other work being done in print or in person who are likewise driven to know and to share. Today, four eminent scholars and artists whose interests bring them into deep conversation with music, history, visual art, architecture, electronic media, and physics and material science are going to have a conversation and talk about our limitation that we've imposed on ourselves today, which has to do with the element of time. So to begin with, I'd like to introduce my friend and colleague in the Department of Music, Professor Judith Perino. She's written two very influential books on art song as it progresses through history, as it relates to other realms of society: gender, sexuality, desire, and the quest for knowledge. She says something very interesting in a recent interview about this panel, as a matter of fact. We need to talk about the humanities in terms of a moral value, a social good, a spiritual enhancement, an ability to understand diverse points of view. She says we need to become a very careful listener and learner, and to develop a complex way of seeing the world, valuing difference, valuing complexity, teaching how to deal with complexity, teaching how to think complexly. Judith is going to talk about her work in the context of medieval studies, and I'd like to welcome you now.
Thank you for coming out today. I'm going to be talking about my work on medieval love songs. Medieval might not be what you expect from a panel about the cutting edge, but medieval studies is becoming more and more obscure these days in the academy, and therefore obscurity, cutting edge, starts to make some sense. I want to talk about what I call the time travel of medieval song. I'm going to give you a glimpse of how the study of medieval songs engages current issues and questions about the ontology of the self, the nature of being in relationship to time and the environment and material and even metaphysical worlds. So I'm going to begin with one of my favorite stanzas from a troubadour named Cercamon. Troubadours were in the southern part of France, and they wrote in Occitan, which is, those of you who speak Catalan might recognize it. It's a kind of a combination of French and Spanish. So I'll just read this out loud, because it's such a succinct encapsulation of troubadour love songs. "Alas, I have never gained anything from love except the suffering and the anguish, and nothing is so hard to win over as that which I desire, and nothing fills me with such desire as does that which I cannot have." Now, James Taylor or Lana Del Rey could have written this stanza. It seems to give us a truth, a kind of maladaptive psychological truth about the nature of desire. That is, we want what we cannot have. And that is key to reading troubadour love songs, this idea of perpetual desire, desire that is never ending. And it is that desire, perpetual desire through time, not consummated, that is generative of the song and generative of the troubadour's very self, his very being. This is what we are going to be tracking in some of these songs. The woman, this is a very metaphysical type of love. The women in love songs are, medieval love songs are very abstract, very generic. Very few particulars are given to them. They are sort of ciphers for the troubadour himself. So moving on, I'm going to give us another example. And what I'm going to do is have this example played, the melody, and then I'll talk you through some of the things that we're going to be seeing on in the lyrics. So just read along as the melody plays, so please.
L'ancani giun sun lungen mar Es beis tus chans dozes de lun E can mes ne partit de la Remembram din amur de Vocte talam er brux eclis Sic eciams ni flus d'albespi Platz blies, kehl in Welt gelas.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about sort of four key aspects of this song. The first is the motif of distance. Distance in hearing the birds through memory, distance, love, this idea of amour de loin, this is the key phrase that repeats in seven stanzas of this song. It is the kind of poetic motif that is encapsulating this perpetual desire that we read about in the other example. So here's a little bit more stylized, a little bit more poeticized version of perpetual love in this idea of distant love. We're not quite sure what distance is here, whether it's time or place. It's a little vague, and both time and place markers are important here. So this motif of distance is one thing. The second thing are temporal markers of seasons. We start out with this conjuring of May and springtime, very typical in troubadour songs where the voice of the troubadour emerges from the voice of nature, emerges from the environment, from birdsong, from springtime. But you might have also noticed that by the end of this stanza, we have a mention of another season, icy winter. And this brings up a third important aspect of troubadour love songs, that is antitheses. They love to be putting contrasting images together and working through that paradox. So we start out in May generating the song itself. We end up in icy winter. That is usually an antithesis, not always in Ithaca, however. We can always have a snowstorm in May. Yeah. So the other antithesis that is going on here is pleasure and icy winter. You don't usually think of those things together. Also, the ways in which the bird songs give pleasure, sweet memory in the top part of the stanza, and by the bottom part of the stanza, the bird songs are part of a burden of desire. So these paradoxes and conflicts are very much a part of troubadour song. Now, the final thing I want to mention here has to do with the music. You might have noticed that this is a delivery which is kind of very chant-like. There's no actual meter. You can't, snap your fingers to it or anything. So this is because it's a very conservative interpretation of this song. We don't have the notation of time in these songs, what musicians might call time or meter. We just have melody, and the notation doesn't give us any indication of how to perform the melody in time, in meter. So there's new interpretations that are always improvisatory in some way. This seems to be also a very conscious decision of the scribes, is not to impose temporal values on these notes. So that's an important aspect of this music as well. So I want to talk a little bit now, moving from the metaphysics of desire to the actual materiality of the transmission record of this music. There's a 100-year gap between the troubadour's historical dates. Geoffrey Roudel flourishes about 1150. His music doesn't get written down until 1250. So this is a historical gap that many medievalists and classicists have to deal with. What happens in that 100 years is quite complicated, something we have to try to sort of imagine. And then we also have to deal with these artifacts, which, as you can see, have sustained a certain amount of damage, the sort of wreckage of time in these manuscripts. They archive not only the songs, but events, loss, and here, violence. So what you're seeing here in this, it would be your right. The right-hand side is actually how that song that you just heard gets transmitted. It is on this page, that is the notation of this song, but you can see it's been badly damaged, sort of brutally damaged by probably someone in the 19th century who cut away the illumination. The illumination would have looked like something on the order of what you see on the other page, a knight on horseback, which depicts the noble status of the troubadour. So sometime in the 19th century, it was cut out and sold in book trade. This became a thing to do. So not only did they cut out the illumination, but they also cut into the music. And this is a sort of interesting and tragic record of loss and the devaluation of the content of this manuscript, the increase in a kind of market value for the pretty thing of the illumination, and a decrease in interest in what actually is archived in the music. But even before the 19th century, these manuscripts offer a kind of interesting archive of loss in the blank staves that you can see in the other side. This is a manuscript, quite elaborate, very well planned, but the plan couldn't be fully executed. Many staves are left empty, sort of waiting for their music that never arrives. And I want to say that we should sort of really think about the condition that of this archive of loss and lost knowledge. This should be a warning for us in the present, especially with cuts in education and in the humanities, this way of cutting and losing knowledge over time is a deep problem, losing creative culture. So this song, I want to argue, the staves here, in a way, we can see them as emblematic of perpetual desire, this sort of perpetual desire for this lost cultural object of the love song, now 100 years from Geoffrey Rudel. Okay, I'm going to end now with one example of a reuse of this love song. It captured the imagination. This particular love song, the idea of distance, was reimagined by Kaija Saariaho. She's a contemporary Finnish composer working in Paris, and she used this song in two different compositions. I only have time to talk about the one from 1996, Lonja. This is the word for distance or afar, and it is a composition for voice and electronics, a soprano voice, so changing the subject of the lyric subject of the troubadour from male to female is an interesting thing to keep track of. But also, it's a combination of a live voice and pre-recorded electronics that have also a live aspect of reverb, so that the voice can be fed into an electronic system, giving some real-time interaction with the soprano, but also embedded in an environment of electronic sounds. So I'm going to have just a couple of stanzas played from this, and I'll have to signal the tech support up there to when I want to begin and stop. So I'll signal when to stop as well. You're going to hear these excerpts of two or three different stanzas. The first one, you're going to hear the soprano sing the melody quite cleanly. It's going to emerge out of this kind of electronic haze of pre-recorded and sort of heavy reverb sound. There's going to be electronic bird sound in here, so you're going to get the conjuring of that springtime that's part of the original song. But it's going to be electronic, so there's going to be perhaps a sort of eerie technological nature that you're going to hear as well. And then as the piece progresses from one stanza to the next, the song becomes more and more disrupted. The voice of the singer becomes more fragmented. Other sort of strange, intrusive sounds come to play. There's a lot more of a kind of aggressive, a percussive aspect, these very high chiming sounds, which seem to start to dissipate the voice of the singer. So I'm going to have that played right now. Some thoughts about the Sarajevo piece. If you had a keen ear, you would have noticed that she's not really using the tune of the troubadour. The troubadour's tune is kind of a palimpsest below her own melody line. She's sort of following roughly the contours of the song, but it becomes kind of this raw material, kind of like the bird song of the troubadour stanza. The troubadour song becomes her raw material for the production of her own voice and her own melody. So I'm going to conclude with some thoughts here. In the medieval song, the bird's song and springtime generates the troubadour's voice. In Sarajevo, the troubadour generates Sarajevo's voice to a certain extent, but the natural human voice in this composition seems to be generated by the electronic voices and bird songs that surround it. And this electronic technological environment seems to envelop, but also fragment the human voice over time in this stanzas. And this whole piece is 15 minutes long. If the troubadour love song poses the questions, what is the time of the song? What is the time of the self? What are the contingencies of the self and self-expression? Then Sarajevo's reimagining seems to ask some related questions. What is the time and sound of a voice? What is the distance between the self, the voice, and sound in general? And finally, what is the relationship of distance and desire between past and present voices? And I'm going to end my presentation there. Thank you.
Thanks to Judith. By the way, here's the way we're going to proceed. We'll have a presentation by each of our four panelists, and then we'll have ample time for questions, partly as a conversation among ourselves and partly with a conversation with you. We'll invite your questions as things go along. So make notes. That's okay. I'd like to introduce you to Jenny Sabin. Here's a little excerpt from a profile on her and her work. Architects like to poach design elements from the life sciences. A DNA helix here, a spherical nucleus there. But Cornell architecture professor Jenny Sabin goes even more interdisciplinary. "I'm not interested in just making buildings from beautiful forms and biology," she says. Her experimental installations draw from just about every department on campus. The article goes on to describe an architectural project that draws from the biology of cell structure. A few years ago, Jenny's collaborative work was cited by the journal Science for Science, not art, not, you know, architecture, for outstanding achievement in the use of visual media to promote understanding of research results and scientific phenomena. Jenny's presentation today will describe a project she's currently involved in that's in collaboration with a composer, a physicist, and a materials scientist, Jenny Sabin.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us this morning. Okay, so today I will be talking about one specific project addressing an architecture of change across multiple length scales and also disciplines. And I'm going to start out with a statement that defines the trajectory of the work. And in the background, you'll see a number of data sets, models, and visualizations that I've produced in collaboration with a number of my collaborators. Biology presents useful conceptual models for architects to consider, where form is in constant adaptation with environmental events. Here, geometry and matter operate together as an active, elastic ground, what I call a datascape, that steers and specifies form, function, and structure, and importantly, in context. Through direct references to the flexibility and sensitivity of the human body, I'm interested in developing adaptive materials and architecture where code, pattern, environmental cues, geometry, and matter operate together as a conceptual design space across disciplinary boundaries. It is the embedding of material systems with biological relationships and behavior to generate models that are at once natural and also artificial. On a meta level, this marks a shift away from Cartesian formal orders of column, beam, and arch, and towards interiorities, networks, fabrics, and topological meanders that are pliable, plastic, and open across multiple length scales through time and in space. Now, one of the questions that we ask is the following. How might buildings, in the context of issues of sustainability and building energy, behave more like organisms responding to and adapting to their built environments? Now, I've been collaborating with people across disciplines from cell biology, material science, mechanical engineering, systems engineering, physics, music, and so on for over a decade now. And in the beginning, it was very much process-orientated. We didn't necessarily have any goals set, and that was scripted by purpose. But now that has been organized into the following three areas of project work and fundamental research, starting with adaptive materials, which span the production of tapestries and datascapes, to the design and engineering of adaptive building skins that are interactive, engaging topics such as structural color. And the second phase includes adaptive structures, which may be inspired by biological data sets, engaging contemporary fabrication techniques such as 3D printing to work with much more non-standard forms, interrogating the dimensions of a brick. How might bricks be different as in their individuality, but come together as a coherent whole at the macro scale and also the micron scale. Learning from networking behavior from the human body to develop spatial structures, and in this case, composed of over 1,400 digitally produced, 3D printed, and hand cast ceramic forms. And the third category, the production of adaptive environments, or the generation of scientifically based design-oriented applications in contemporary architecture practice for adaptive building systems, protocols, and material assemblies. And this is a knitted pavilion that I did for Nike. Now, all of the work now follows basically three phases in the pursuit of a responsible engagement of scale over multiple disciplines and timescapes. Whether it's engaging fundamental research or a commissioned project, we typically start out with a production of a tool palette to model behavior and process, not things and shapes. Some of those tools are then brought into the realm of architectural prototyping to productively contaminate the process with the stuff of architecture, the stuff of making, and then moving some of those successful prototypes into the building scale and engaging issues of building ecology. It's a slow process. So I'm going to talk about one project in that context. And related to the question that I posed in the beginning, we're also very interested in the notion of a personalized architecture. How might we begin to tune and adapt our own environments? Now, this project is called eSkin, and this is the team of collaborators that I work with. It's funded by the National Science Foundation. It's a multi-million dollar grant that we received in 2010 to engage the topic of sustainability. But importantly, the NSF was very interested in reconceptualizing our entire approach to the problem. And how might we engage disciplines, multiple disciplines, to do that? And so we started with this point of departure, which is called dynamic reciprocity, stemming from cell biology, specifically matrix biology. And in matrix biology, the big idea is looking outside of the cell itself to a landscape of information, of protein events, an architecture that acts upon form, right? So in this case, we have a single cell, a smooth muscle cell, a human cell, and it's plated onto a PDMS, or organic polymer substrate. And we're interested in how changes in compliance and materiality, geometry, and pattern in turn alter changes within the cell itself. You can actually see the cytoskeleton lassoing up and around these pillars. Now, in our proposal, which entailed the development of adaptive building skins, passively responsive building skins that could learn and adapt over time to environmental cues, did not entail proposing to put human cells on building skins. Human cells work very well in our own body, but they would not operate very well on buildings. But instead, they were stand-ins to understand this fine-scale design ecology, a reciprocity, a dynamic reciprocity of multiple feedback loops over time and in space to look at a morphology of form that could engage functional issues of sustainability. As you can see in this example, which is a predefined geometric pattern embedded within a shape memory polymer material, displaying structural color change over deformation and recovery. So in this case, the color change is not pigment-based. It's based on how light reflects and refracts relative to changes in geometry and pattern at a nano to micro scale. We're also very interested in issues of perception alongside the functional properties of the e-skin material and how it engages issues of building energy and moisture. In the context of tuning our own environments, what does that mean in the context of an urban scale, of large-scale transformations of color and light? These are some of the more mature speculations, looking at the promise of a tunable window. Again, personalizing our own architecture at the scale of a room, local response or sensing-based color change, and also global response, working with environmental cues, in this case, ambient incident light. Now, we have some limitations. Currently, we can only fabricate 4 inches maximum of the e-skin material, and that has to do with time and also funds in terms of its production. We're probably realistically between 6 to 8 years away from an industry-ready product that could be integrated with existing building construction as well as new facade design. So we've been developing a number of prototypes to test how some of these features and effects could scale across multiple length scales, including the macro scale or the human scale. This was a prototype that we produced for an exhibition at the Froc in Orléans, just outside of Paris. And we are interested in switching between opaque, transparent, and color. Now, due to the limitations in fabrication, we decided to work with a material that behaves identically to the PDMS, or organic polymer, that we're working with, but can be scaled to our eye. And so we worked with what are called nanocolloidal particles. They're what you frequently find in shells, seashells, that display opulent colors. They're found in milk products, anything that basically displays an opulent color scheme. And so this was the prototype that we developed, some early schematics for that. Everything was custom made. We collaborated across labs, the cell biologists, the material scientists, myself and my team, everything custom made, and a view of the final prototype. And so what you see here is an array of sensors. They detect changes in light intensity. So when you pass by this or wave a hand in front of it, a regional charge is sent to the components, which are produced with 2 sheets of ITO glass, which is a conductive glass, and a solution of the nanocolloidal particles is sandwiched within that. And so what the charge does is it changes the packing density of those particles, which in turn, to our eye, changes the color and therefore the transparency. So again, engaging this topic of structural color, so it's not pigment-based. We've been fortunate to receive a second NSF grant, which forms a bridge with a lot of the work that we've been producing with the eSkin project. And in this case, looking at folding, and in a particular sense, looking at kirigami, which is origami, but with the addition of the strategic placement of cuts and holes. We're interested in working with 3D origami across multiple length scales from the nano to the macro, shaping and folding elastic sheets. One of my collaborators here, Dr. Dan Lau, who is a bioengineer, is 3D printing DNA sequences inspired by the human body into polymer substrates to program material passively to get it to fold and adapt over multiple time states. So one of our recent prototypes, titled Color Folds, we produced last fall as an experiment. It was installed in the architecture department for approximately 4 months, where we're working with the same principles developed in the eSkin project, but looking at how we can move away from single swaths of this material into larger assemblies that also adapt and respond to environmental cues, including the presence of us. Now, the prototype displays three levels of behavior, and we've treated it as an ongoing experiment. The first is awareness of its environment, so it folds and adapts to your presence. The second is an awareness of itself, so the components begin to understand behavior relative to its neighbor. And then the second is a degree of feedback, which is basically a combination of the two. Again, mining this notion of reciprocity between environment and code as a communicative landscape that produces form that adapts over time and in space. Dynamic morphology. This just gives you a sense of how the components are produced. They include a nitinol spring, which is known as a shape memory polymer. So with a very low voltage charge, these springs contract and relax, and in turn close, fold, and open the components. We work with contemporary digital fabrication techniques. This is a CNC machine, a computer numerically controlled machine, to produce the components. Every single one of them is different, but they come together as a coherent whole. And this just gives you a sense of the assembly process, as well as the degree of color change, which again is not based on pigment, but is based on your viewing angle, so relative to your position to the prototype, as well as changes in light. We worked with Hod Lipson and his Creative Machines Lab, specifically Daniel Salucci, a PhD student that we co-advise, to integrate mechatronics, which controls the behavior of the folding. And this just gives you a sense of how that operates. So not only is your position to the material altering the color, but the folding behavior is also, in turn, eliciting a degree of change. We like to make stuff. All of this was made from scratch. We probably won't ever do that again. Again, a very slow process, but the important thing here is process as research, design as research. And a final view of Color Folds, the prototype installed on the third floor of Sibley. And again, this is the same material, but it's the viewing angle that changes the color and degree of transparency. Now, recently, we've been collaborating with a composer, Gene Coleman, who I've had an ongoing discussion with for approximately 3 years now. And he's very interested in how algorithms may organize compositions and the way that he steers them across space and time. And he's since been working with, over discussions with myself, principles of kirigami. How might folding become an organizer in the context of his compositions. And we had a joint performance last fall in Philadelphia where both myself, Xu Yang, the material scientist who I've been collaborating with for a number of years, and Randy Kamian, the physicist who's involved with the Kirigami project, gave a joint lecture on the topic of Kirigami, but across multiple disciplines. This is just a short presentation of some of the work. If you're interested in looking at more of it, please visit our sites. We have a number of wonderful funders that help us produce the work. And I'll just conclude with the following statement. While the exploration of biological and nano to micro-scale material properties and effects at the human scale form the starting points for many of the featured projects, the disciplinary hurdles that we encounter through the production of projects across scales culminate in what is perhaps the most potent deliverable, a new model for transdisciplinary collaboration. The scalar constraints that we encounter span material science, cell biology, textile engineering, fashion sport, electrical and systems engineering, and architecture, which in turn challenge the differences between fundamental and applied research. Through the collaborative production of these applications, we encounter key differences between the conceptualization and materialization of the projects whose success demand that science, engineering, the arts, and music meet. The creative navigation of this ambiguous line between science, the arts, and architecture in turn offers up a unique model for collaboration across disciplines that defines a new future for the architect, where authorship is horizontal, giving way to interiorities, elastic networks, fabrics, and topological meanders that are pliable, plastic, ecological, and open. And perhaps the most important deliverable to date is this new model for collaboration across disciplines, where the pliable plane or an active datascape forms a bridge and a point of departure. And I don't work alone. These are a few members of my team. Thank you very much.
That was stunning. And we'll have a chance to converse with Jenny and the rest of our panelists at the end of these presentations. So please save your questions and have them at the ready. Associate Professor Benjamin Pickett in the Department of Music. I'd like to just give you a sense of his wide-ranging accomplishments. He's a historian of American music. That includes jazz, avant-garde music, and rock after 1960. He is a prolific author. His monograph, Experimentalism Otherwise, The New York Avant-Garde and Its Limits, was published in 2011 by University of California Press. And it portrays New York experimentalism writ large in the 1960s as a series of conflicts, struggles, and exclusions. He's also the editor of two books on the avant-garde, and one of them is a two-volume collaborative work with the extraordinary musician and scholar George Lewis, which is forthcoming. Another element of his past, Ben's past, is an essay he wrote in the Drama Review, Deadness, that he co-authored with Jason Stanyak, and it received the Outstanding Article Award in 2011 from the Association of Theater in Higher Education. Okay, he's a musician, he's writing in Drama Review, theater, and was selected by MIT Press as one of its 50 most influential articles in all disciplines in the history of its journals division. Ben is currently working on a biography of the English experimental rock band Henry Cow, a play on the name of a very influential avant-garde musician, of composer of the early 20th century, Henry Cowell. Ben is going to give us a talk on a title, Frozen Time. Ben Pickett.
Thank you for coming. embarking on an adventure in collaborative PowerPoint control. So bear with us if we need a second. Okay, I'd like to begin this talk on time with a description of a well-known sound installation by the U.S. composer Lamont Young. The piece, called The Dream House, is interesting in the context of this panel session because it offers a sonic experience built on the suspension of time rather than on its unfolding. In short, there is no time in this piece, only space. As we will see and hear, of course, the situation is more complicated than that. So born in Idaho in 1935, Young had moved to New York City in late 1960 when he began a series of explorations of alternative tuning, high amplitude, and melodic improvisation. He was a gifted jazz saxophonist. Young and his collaborators carried out these experiments in an ensemble called the Theater of Eternal Music. This group played loud, droning music in a tuning system called Just Intonation. They often played along to an oscillator that generated pure sine waves, as we are doing now, because it called attention to individual pitches that might have drifted out of tune. So we're going to fade up in a second. You'll hear in tune, drifting out of tune, and then back into tune. It was a music based on visceral experience. At high volumes, going out of tune produced a certain friction in the form of beating. Individual and group rehearsal, as well as public performances, were simply long and ultimately impossible attempts to eliminate beats. Time, in the form of audible change, was a kind of necessary side effect based on the inherent fallibility of human performers. Now, for the Dream House, Young began moving up the harmonic series. In Western art music based in equal temperament, we hear usually up to about the first 15 partials. That's what structures harmonic space. In the Dream House, Young began adding the 29th partial, the 31st partial, the 59th, the 61st, and so on and so on and so on, all the way up above the 2000th partial. There are 35 pitches in total. Because of the complexity of the chord that he created, he could not employ human musicians, so the Dream House was made using a bank of oscillators and loudspeakers in the four corners of the room. So many visitors to this installation cannot believe that the sound is unvarying, without shifts in dynamics or the components of the chord. It's a single chord, there's no change. That's because when sounded at sufficient amplitudes, the 35-note chord creates standing waves in the room, which are like columns of fluctuating pressure where individual pitches get amplified or attenuated depending on whether your ear is physically located at the peak or the valley of the sound wave. So to achieve this effect, one generally needs a rectangular volume that isn't too big. And for this reason, I doubt that we can recreate these standing waves in this room now, especially because I can only generate half of those 35 pitches at once from my computer. But we can give it a try. So I will turn up the volume. It has to be loud, okay? It has to be loud. So give me a sign if it gets too loud. And you should be able to recreate a superficial version of these psychoacoustic effects by just turning your head side to side. Okay, music is that's a good way to wake yourself up on a Sunday. Music is a temporal art. It takes you through time. But the Dream House does something else. Impassively, it gives the listener no time. It is only space. The piece reformulates time into a measure of one's own perception. So as a music historian, I've always been more interested in the formation of institutions and networks than I have been in the aesthetics of individual works, even ones as strange and compelling as the Dream House. But my historical work, along with that of several colleagues, takes a cue from the Dream House. How does it do this? By freezing historical time and investigating the results. I'll show you what I mean by way of a second example. Although he was 5 years younger than Young, Henry Flint moved to New York at about the same time, in the early 60s, when Young had developed a coterie of like-minded artists and musicians. Flint's work explored the same kind of trancing hypnotic states as that of Young. So here he is performing a piece called Violin Strobe, which dates to the late 1960s. For the most part, scholarly appraisals of Flint's work have continually placed him within a diachronic temporal lineage of downtown experimentalism. I think of it as the biblical mode. John Cage begat Lamont Young, who begat Henry Flint, and so on. This kind of closed interpretation, based on a temporal progression, I think has kept scholars from recognizing the diverse worlds and intellectual currents that the artist Henry Flint was traversing. I've argued that we have much to gain by freezing that relentless temporality and instead looking outward to other concurrent formations that he explored. For example, in 1963 and 64, Flint produced a series of anti-art protests in the city. At the Museum of Modern Art, the Metropolitan and Lincoln Center, the newly constructed Lincoln Center, he and his colleagues shouted slogans and displayed picket signs that read, "Destroy art and demolish Lincoln Center." These demonstrations culminated in a pair of events in 1964, where Flint targeted performances of works by Karlheinz Stockhausen, regarded by many as a kind of pinnacle of the post-war avant-garde. "Fight racist laws of music," his group shouted. These events produced a lot of confusion. Critics from the Uptown New York Times and the Downtown Village Voice both mistakenly assumed that Flint's protest on the sidewalk was a part of the equally chaotic happening, Stockhausen's Originale, that was taking place inside the hall. Because many of these performers, like some of Flint's picketers, were associated with the Fluxus movement of experimental performance, some observers thought that Originale had programmed its own protest. So the critics didn't get it. In the longer view, art historians haven't fared much better. The anti-art stance was a common one in a downtown scene that was operating in the wake of John Cage's silent piece, 4 minutes and 33 seconds. And a project to demolish serious culture would not have looked out of place in a milieu that was constantly pondering the dematerialization of the art object. Accordingly, historians have tended to explain these demonstrations from inside the frames of art history and aesthetics, or even as a kind of intertribal artist's spat. But such misinterpretations should be dispelled by a glance at the leaflet that Flint handed out at the protests. Surely one of the most audacious documents on politics and culture of the 1960s. In it, he argued that art music had supported European claims to global supremacy by developing so-called laws of music to police and dismiss non-Western cultures. Flint points to the musicologist Alfred Einstein's denigrating statements on jazz as an example of a powerful apparatus that produces the standards by which musical value is assessed. The first cultural task, he wrote, is publicly to expose and fight the domination of white European US ruling class art. He further elaborated this critique in other publications that highlighted the technologically advanced and musically progressive politics of black vernacular styles. So it's this critique that was leading him to that rather abstract fiddling style that we hear in Violin Strobe. So Flint arrived at this analysis of class, race, imperialism, and culture by way of the Workers' World Party, a Marxist-Leninist organization that expressed an early commitment to anti-imperialist struggles, third world Marxism, and militant black nationalism. As a member of the party, Flint attended meetings and demonstrations for several years. In the pages of their newspaper, for which he was a writer and editor, he would have read many stories about Robert F. Williams, a former official of the NAACP who had publicly advocated meeting violence with violence. A few years later, Williams fled to Cuba to escape a trumped-up kidnapping charge. The journalist Mark Schleifer, a kind of lefty journalist, who was one of Henry Flint's demonstrators, had traveled to Havana in 1962 to interview Williams. He later edited these conversations into a book called Negroes with Guns, which became one of the enduring publications of the civil rights movement. So I am piling up all of these details in order to show that Flint was motivated by a set of concerns that were not reducible to those of music or art history. By refusing an approach that would place him in that endless temporal progression of historical figures and styles, this method instead allows for transverse history that overflows and eludes those more familiar disciplinary limits. This move can open up the scholarly conversation to new terrain. In short, then, I am sketching out a method for one kind of history writing that tries to step outside of time, or at least to avoid the limiting effects of too much temporal thinking. At the very least, it would be a stretch to say that this method owes something to the Dream House, but it does obey a similar rule: bracket time and investigate the results. Thank you.
Our limitation was time, and our mode was conversation, right? Our discussion here has to do with the kinds of engagement that happen when we allow ourselves to converse with other like-minded scholars and individuals and artists. And we're seeing just a sampling of the huge variety that's available to us when we travel down that path. Our final panelist is John Cicevici, Associate Professor in Architecture. His large-scale installations involving digital media, robotics, and videos have been exhibited in a variety of locations, including the Phoenix Museum of Art, the Birchfield Penny Art Center, Tsinghua University in Beijing, and the Herbert F. Johnson Museum of Art in Ithaca, New York. Cicevici received his bachelor's and master's of architecture from Cornell. He's going to talk about a recent film that he's made in collaboration with a dear friend of ours, Tailan Sihan. Thank you.
I would like to do less talking and more showing, but due to time constraints, which is one of our themes here, I'm only going to be showing you two-thirds of this film. All I'll say about it at the beginning is how it was made. It was made, and this is an exaggeration because this is a big version of it, on the iPhone 5. Exclusively, I put it together in some editing software, but it was just a way to get it out of here and to be able to present it in another dimension. I've been interested in visualizations of the city like Google Earth and Street View, and how those visualizations affect the way we actually see cities and experience cities, and how they create a new kind of vision. And in collaboration with Talon, as was mentioned, who also works similarly, that's how we decided to collaborate, because the way you navigate the city in Google Earth and Street View is through three fingers, and that's what you will see there, is the effect of that in this netherworld now between Street View and Google Earth, and I'm sure you're all familiar with those, which eventually I assume will become ways that we actually see the cities in real time, or kind of hybrid way. So I'll just start the film and I'll say a few things about it afterwards. And you'll only see two-thirds of it.
Thank you.
This film is about nothing as far as I'm concerned, but it certainly raises some questions for it, and it raised them for me only after I made it, because I'm not fully in control of what happens or where it goes. Roughly, I decided a part of the city to look at, but all my thoughts about it came after making it. And what's interesting to me about it is that through this kind of cutting, which is purely a function of what Google lets me do, because I'm in some realm that they don't want me to be, and often I get kicked out of there. It to me, it embodies a kind of state of distraction that is the way we begin to see the world more and more. Always our attention being split between this and what is out there, and more it's a kind of oscillation between two ways of being and two ways of seeing the world. It's also about two kinds of cities, the cities that's constantly under observation, making the data and the images here are a result of satellite images, aerial photography, ground level documentation of Google Earth. So there's this whole other world that the city is created by, or another city is created by. And that's one city here. And the other city is the city that always observes us and reacts and responds to us. So it's this sort of split between these two worlds of the city constantly under observation and the city that is constantly observing us and responding to us and reading data from our phones and sending us messages more and more based on where we are, who we are, what our habits are. And so we are always in this kind of dual world. You can invent all kinds of other things that it might be about for you, how you've seen it. And I think I'll leave it at that, because it would be good to have some time for discussion and questions and whatever. So thank you.
Yeah. Let me invite the rest of the panelists to come up and sit in these lovely, comfortable chairs. Again, thank you all the panelists for really exciting presentations. And I'd like to just think of a couple of things thematically that strike me in the context of all the presentations. One thing that I think about a lot is reverberation in my own work. And the notion of reverberation is something that I can see sort of thematically happening throughout all the presentations. What I mean by that is that reverberation, you know, sort of the lingering echo of a sound, but not exactly a slap back imprint of the sound. It's something that just sort of conveys something. It conveys space. You know, it takes a certain amount of time for travel, for a sound to travel and then come back, and then sort of bounce around a hall. And through that, we intuit how big that space is. We also make some intuitions about time. You know, time is used as a way of adding a certain kind of gravitas to the sound that we might hear. And I can also see reverberations across expanses of time, historical time. So I'm hearing reverberation in several of the musical pieces that we heard, some of the sounds that we heard. Certainly, I heard it in the Sarajevo piece, the electronic sounds that were being generated. Not just were sounds themselves, but they were also echoes of themselves in a certain way, through which the vocalist, you know, penetrated. I also heard that in the strobe violin piece, where reverberation starts to become a sort of a feedback loop that builds sound upon sound upon sound and adds a certain psychic weight to the proceedings of what's going on. And definitely in Tylon's accompaniment to the to the film just now by John. It's laden with different elements of what I would call ambient reverberation, although they're not necessarily reverberations themselves because these are all electronically produced, as in the case of the Sarajevo piece. So I was just wondering, for those people who were doing something with sound, how reverberation enters into the connotations of reverberation enter into your understanding of the work you're doing. We'll get to the images in a second.
Well, I can begin in that you can use reverberation and in metaphorical ways. Certainly, the Geoffrey Rudel piece reverberates through time. It's one of the most popular pieces in the Middle Ages, and then it captures the imagination, Sarajevo, eventually in the 20th century. Space and sound are always sort of creating each other, as well as the input of time into that factor. But there was reverb on, to be a little more literal about reverberation, there was reverb on the recording of the troubadour song. Paul Hillier sang that early rendition of the melody, and to recreate the sort of sonic environment of the Middle Ages, which would have been reverberant in churches or in castle, great rooms and so forth. So troubadour song less so, but other types of composition in the Middle Ages used the reverberation of the cathedral and created these kind of sonic experiments with drones and getting all the pitches of the scale sort of floating in the space at once. So they certainly were interested in using space, and they created hockets, which had stereophonic effect and so forth. So
kick
it to.
I just want to mention the way that I made this piece. I had gone to a concert by Talon, and I just the way one should never do, I took out my phone and I started playing with it while he was creating these sounds live. And I was creating these images, I wasn't recording them, but that's when I realized the sort of connection between the two. And what one of the things that got me, not just that we were working the same way, but the images which I'm attempting to get close to something in all these kind of movements, and the thing kicks me back. It doesn't allow me, so I keep getting the same approach and the same image. It's a kind of reverberation, and I think that's and it's totally determined by what this kind of software gives you, and it is a kind of rhythm, and it's not a literal reverberation, but the repetition of the same thing echoing, a failed attempt at movement is, I think, a kind of version of that visually, in a way.
I'll just say really briefly that,
the example that I played, a violin strobe, is mm-hmm. certainly does have a lot of reverb in it, and one thing I've noticed in a lot of the artists that I'm chasing after in the 1960s, those composers and improvisers are engaged in an ongoing kind of investigation of the properties of sound mediated through electronics. And that investigation probably bore its greatest fruits in the popular music field. In other words, the people discovering the most about how reverb can work in the recorded form were at Sun Studios, were in small spaces in New York City, like Atlantic Studios, developing reverb chambers and plate units. In other words, outside of the academic and university context, which had its own program for understanding architectural ways of thinking about sound. But what I find interesting about the 60s is that these artists are moving around outside of elite and art-identified spaces to engage with those products of research coming up from the vernacular.
I'm really taken by another theme that I'm seeing across the work, having to do with the notions of stasis and movement and adaptability. Jenny's work in particular is very invested in adaptability. And as a musician, I always think of sort of a formal desire for tension and release, that there are certain kinds of tension that are built up, and then the sort of expectation is that that will eventually culminate in some kind of emotional catharsis. And but there are other ways of doing movement, things that have to do with things that don't have a stated beginning and an end. And that brings me to the notion of sort of infinite adaptability that I'm seeing in Jenny's work. But I'd like to kind of get a sense from you of how you see the emotionality of your design.
That's a great question. I mean, to start, the human body is an incredible model for probing active matter and adaptability, and so in all of the work, whether it's starting with an actual data set, bio data set stemming from the human body, or thinking about interaction, there's some element of the human in the work. That in turn, in terms of how we perceive changes and how that elicits an emotional response, I think is incredibly important, because what we're looking at, and we're not quite there yet, is, you know, a move away from thinking about materials as things and elements in buildings, but instead becoming highly immersive and organizing space over multiple time states. And so I think that's also going to radically change the way that we perceive and interact personally with space and form. And I don't quite have a full answer yet to your question. And I think it also demands additional collaborators. We've been talking for a while about the necessity of bringing a psychologist on board to really begin to parameterize and engage issues of perception and the senses in a rigorous way, coming from their disciplinary core, to develop a sensible architecture, and not just sensible, but sensing. Because most of us are probably not very comfortable with buildings moving, but what, if we were to think about a time scale that is actually quite slow, but is really about engaging degrees of feedback and change and learning within the context of materials, I'm pretty excited about that.
Yeah, one thing that is definitely true with everybody on stage is how deeply they are in conversant with other people, with other scholars, with other artists, with other designers, and I'm wondering how those conversations are taking place. I mean, you met somebody at MIT yesterday that you've been wanting to talk to for a very long time. We're always in conferences and trying to engage with each other. But some of these things are really amazingly fruitful conversations that then have real results in the work that we do. And I'm just wondering where those conversations are coming from. Are they serendipitous? Are they sought out? Is there an agenda involved?
Over beer.
Over beer.
I can speak for myself. That's how I met my collaborator, and I happened to go to his performance, and that's when I got the idea of actually doing something together. We used to be able to keep a bottle in our office at school. It's a no-no by now, but I think it's a really sad development, because so many of the kinds of barriers that we build up, within departments, between departments, are so easily overcome with a little lubrication, but we can't do that anymore because it's, I probably can't even talk about it.
One of my first collaborators, who I mentioned, Dr. Peter Lay Jones, he's a cell biologist, matrix biologist. He was taking one of his afternoon walks across campus after lunch and noticed a sign for a conference that I had co-organized that was a part of what was then called the Nonlinear Systems Organization. And he saw the sign and said, wait a minute, I'm a nonlinear systems biologist. What are these architects doing? And so he wandered in and ended up spending the entire day. And we struck up a conversation. And so for me, just long story short, I mean, it's really been about relationships, cultivating relationships and friendships, because not everyone is comfortable collaborating across disciplines, which is fine. But it's, I think that's really key in terms of sustaining a trust and pushing the work forward.
Well, I would say that part of what, the way I've gathered information, I work in two different fields, medieval studies is one of them. I also work in the area of rock music and gender and sexuality. So I have a foot in another world, which is often generating a lot of different ways of thinking about music and identity and subjectivity and sexuality in the process of self-expression. And I've been in conversation with a lot of those scholars and those theorists. And I pulled that work into the way I approach the study of love songs in the Middle Ages is really key to sort of this question of what is the self, what is expressive. We treat the Middle Ages so often as a kind of museum, you know, and sort of impenetrable museum. But to understand the sort of complexity of time and expressivity in these songs. So I think for me, collaboration has been partly self-generated because I've decided to work on these two specialties and they cross-fertilize. And also, you know, various opportunities at Cornell, sitting on a PhD committee with, you know, an external member or being on the faculty senate or getting invited into, you know, the Mellon postdoc seminars and things like that. These are they're kind of very crucial and critical ways in which you are forced to circulate and always in the end, you know, happily circulating and just talking, reading, and being open to a lot of different ways of being inspired, you know, very casually. I'm sure today's panel I'll come away with thinking about the skin on buildings now in a way I never thought about them before. Whether I want my buildings to move or not, I'm not sure.
We're out of time. So let me just, wrap this up by just talking very briefly about the humanities, which is where we're coming from. We're talking about artistic expression and investigation. There are outcomes for people studying the humanities that we are in the process of articulating to ourselves, to alumni, to the administration, to the world outside. And these take a couple of different forms. One is practical benefits, industrial benefits that we're seeing displayed here in our work. Ideas from within the arts can have a deep and lasting effect on both the questions that drive scientific research and the techniques that can answer them, especially important in a world in which students are increasingly aware that their ultimate career path may not even exist by the time they graduate. They need critical thinking skills, which the humanities can give them. They need the ability to analyze and express an idea, and they need the flexibility that the humanities can offer them generally. But there's also another element. Benefits within the arts themselves, which we're also seeing today. We need more people to create beauty in this world. We need more people to push our sense of meaning in the world, to use the arts to deepen our understanding of those arts and to larger contexts in which they exist. And as Judith Perrino expressed in an interview, we need to articulate moral value, a social good, a spiritual enhancement, an ability to understand diverse points of view. We need more conversations. Thank you.